I looked a little further in that book, and I found number 7. And I looked at number 7, and I thought, oh, wouldn't it be kind of exciting to sing the last stanza? Continuing in the same, let's go right to 8. This one, here again, that last stanza. O light of light, explore and chase our gloom away with luster shining more and more until the perfect day. You don't know this hymn. Never heard this. Starts out with a Pentecost theme, but it ends with a theme of affirmation that could be used at a funeral. O light of light, explore and chase our... O light of light, explore and chase our gloom away. Just that much. O light of light, explore and chase our gloom away. And the next time says, with luster shining more and more and more unto the more and more, more and more. Oh, I'm sorry, okay. With luster shining more, or and more, okay? With luster shining more and more unto the perfect day. Okay, now that we've rehearsed it, let's sing it. Or number 9. They have a ruling 4. That's an interesting question. I should share with you what happened in the committee. People kept saying, why don't we put all the stands in between the stands? So it's not really a game of the community anymore. We've got 17 stands in. And you are going to try to read this. Trevor got it up here. And we can copy it. There is one. So they finally compromised and they came to 4. Okay, the next one, number 9. We know that Christ is raised and dies no more. Embraced by death, he broke its fearful hold, and our despair, he turned to blazing joy. Hallelujah. Give you a little sampling of what there's in this book in terms of hymns that might be used. I know one hymn that has already been used, and it's number 3. And it's a person that was at Holden 2 summers ago. Two summers, just last summer. And between last summer and this summer, that person died. And for his funeral, he asked, it happened to be in a Methodist church, and they have it in their hymn book, that this hymn be sung. And so let's just sing the chorus. Go tell it on the mountain.
At that funeral, they also had bagpipes. I mean, it was not a good one.
That you can't sing a hymn at a funeral. One year when I was at Holden, back in 1968, we got messages that my father was very ill. So I moved back to Minnesota. And I went back to a small church that I grew up in. And we were thinking about what we got from the funeral. And here I am, the actor, on a funeral. And I chose that. And there were people in that parish that were a little serious. They couldn't understand why we had to choose the baptism at the same funeral. Right after that, he sang Arcane 259 from Red Bull. From the standpoint of funeral. We have a great composer in the Lutheran Church, and he continues to be with us. He isn't Missouri Synod, he isn't AELC, he isn't LCA, he isn't ALC, he isn't Lutheran Church of Canada. I don't exactly know what the Synod was in Germany, but a couple hundred years ago he was writing, and he must have thought a lot about death. He must have thought a lot about funerals. I know from an account that I read that when he was on his own death, he wrote an organ composition based on the text, Before Thy Throne, and all of this. And I remember the first time I read that, I thought, I wonder if when I'm on my deathbed, I would be dictating notes to my son-in-law to a text that talks about, hopefully, my destination. Well, that made me think of Johann Sebastian Bach. And tonight, we're going to sing two verses by Bach in which he speaks about death. About death in a very interesting and beautiful way. And the first is Come, gentle death. Cum susurtos. Don't stay away. Come. And there's this marvelous, come gentle death, come blessed peace, come for my spirit is weary. When I read this text, I can't help thinking of my grandmother. I'm sure that must be one of her prayers. She's 105. But Bach was attracted to this text and wrote this beautiful music.
Thank you.
The next aria that Bach set to music is from a cantata of the same name called Strike at Last, Thou Our Desire. And all the way through, you hear the bell. Or they're this way. Bells all the way through in the accompaniment. And there's another very interesting pictorial element when the angels. Evidently, the angels are on high, and Bach says, come ye angels down to me. And the accompaniment goes like this. Down they come. So listen for some of those delightful pictorial moments in the music of Bach as he speaks about death.
Thank you.
I could stand all that bell ringing and bowling at my funeral or not. I thought that last, they hit the pin on the last beat. It was just timed perfectly. So you just never know what's going to happen.
I've been teaching a course for, I guess, about the last 7 years in various places, sometimes to pastors and mostly to seminary students on death and dying. And one of the units in the course is really on ritual. And as a part of that unit, we've gone to visit funeral homes and talk to funeral directors in various parts of Ohio, at least. And one of the things that I've learned is that in the cities and suburbs, at least, for Protestants, including Lutherans, the rituals of burial have really been taken out of the hands of the churches very effectively. The funeral director is now in charge of the rituals of burial, and well-meaning people, this is not a knock your funeral director night, they are well-meaning people. And I think a lot of this has been done by default. It hasn't happened yet to the Catholic churches, who have still retained a measure of control over the burial rituals, a significant measure of control, but I think it has happened largely in the cities to the Protestant churches, mostly because we really have not paid much attention to burial rituals. And by rituals, I don't just mean the kinds of things that we do in the church or in the funeral home. I mean the whole ritual, that is, the rituals of grief that we go through. I want to say, first of all, that we need rituals. There is no way that we get through almost anything in life without ritual. When I meet you, we have a ritual, don't we? I hold out my hand. You don't slap it away or ignore it. You hold out yours. We grab hands. That's a ritual. I say, hello, happy to know you. I may not be terribly happy. I may not be exuberant, but I say I'm happy to know you, and maybe even it helps me to be happy to know you. And you say, thank you, happy to know you. And that's a ritual. We do everything in life, finally, by ritual. The first time through, something is a little difficult, but sooner or later, we do a lot of things by ritual, and we don't have to think about them. I don't have to think about toothpaste and toothbrushing in the morning. I couldn't anyway at that hour. I just do it. After a couple of days here at Holden, you get used to what to do with the dishes, and you can keep right on with the conversation and still do what you have to do at the table with the dishes. It's a ritual. It's become a ritual. Going down to the bus at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and saying goodbye is a ritual, and the president of that ritual is Maynard back there, who's beginning to learn what to do with it. Okay, so we need rituals. We need rituals also for our grief and our burying. We have to have them. The question is, what is the quality of these rituals and what shapes them? That is, what makes them the kind of rituals that they are? Funeral directors do not necessarily shape their rituals according to the Christian gospel. And that's fine, because they're in business, not just to bury Christians. They're in business to bury everybody. So they don't really pay all that much attention to the Christian character of the ritual, even when they themselves are practicing Christians. And I know, because I've had funeral directors in my parish. No, I mean, they have to be attuned largely to the wishes of the people. But here is the significant thing. They also shape the options open to us as Christian people. I remember when my father died in 1973, and we wanted to have the casket lowered into the grave at the cemetery. Funeral directors don't do that. They like to have everybody ushered away while the casket is still sitting on top of the ground. But we went to the cemetery to bury my father, and I was not about to have us leave without lowering that casket into the grave and actually throwing some dirt into the grave. I argued with the funeral director for about a half an hour on Monday night before the funeral. He had every possible excuse, but the main reason behind it was that he was afraid of emotional difficulties at the cemetery if we lowered the grave into the body into the ground. I finally said, look, we are the customers. We want this done. You do it or else. I didn't know what I was going to do with that or else, but I said it. And he said, all right, we will arrange it. So the next day at the cemetery, that is what we did. At the words of the clergy person who was presiding over the burial, earth to earth, dust to dust, ashes to ashes, we lowered the casket into the ground as we had done when I was a boy in the prairies in Minnesota. We, you know, just had ropes and lowered the body into the grave. I can still remember the hymns the people used to sing when we did that. It was a hymn called This Body in the Grave We Lay, and it's not in the red book. But we sang it, and then we threw some dirt into there, into the grave. And it was a great and moving thing, but we did what we came to do. Well, after the funeral was over, the funeral director said, my, that was amazing. He said, that was just wonderful. But you see, I had to bring all my customer clout to bear in order to get him to do that, because he was, by and large, shaping the options that he was going to make open to us in the burial ritual. Now, part of that problem, I said, is the church. Part of it is the culture. Most of us, I think, I did at least, grew up in rural western, southwestern Minnesota, where when somebody died, you had the funeral in the middle of the day, and everybody could come to it, even if it was harvest time. You could stop the threshing machines or the binders or whatever for a couple of hours and go up and bury Uncle George. And everybody did. But now we work, you know. We work 8-hour days in offices and factories, and it isn't very easy for us to get time off, and so it's quite convenient to have a small group of people gather in a funeral home on a Thursday morning to bury Uncle George. So that's part of it. But I think the other part of it is that when we get to the church, we don't do all that much differently than you do in the funeral home anyway, so why go to the church? I looked up the order for the burial of the dead on page 253 in the Red Book. I'd just like to ask, how many of you have ever used this order for the burial of the dead? Any of you remember using it? Maynard, I see three hands. You remember using it ever? Mm-hmm. Often?
No.
Not often. Even
not
when we...
Okay. Not with the music, because it's historical.
Exactly.
Okay,
one of the main problems with this liturgy is that they gave us brand new music. Music we never sing any other time. Now this is fine if you have three funerals a week. You know, it'd take you about a month to learn the music, and then of course you could use. But see, most of us go to maybe what, three funerals a year, if at all? And I think it one of the really disastrous things, if you want to kill something, use unfamiliar music, right? That's the surest way for people finally to say, this says nothing to us, this means nothing to us. Jerry is outstanding at helping us to learn new music. I think it's just exciting to learn new things with him. But most of the time, if we don't have familiar music, we're not going to use a ritual. And that's the church's contribution to the problem. The culture doesn't give us time off from 8-hour days, and the church then gives us an unfamiliar burial liturgy, and finally we say, forget it. We'll just stick with a funeral home and some recorded music over the loudspeaker system and some nice words by the minister who has been co-opted for the occasion, and it's, you know, that's finally the way we bury Uncle George. The New Lutheran Book of Worship. And I guess this is one of the reasons why we need a new Lutheran Book of Worship. If we didn't learn from some of the mistakes in the Red Book, then we'd really be stupid up here. And so I think we have learned some things about... Incidentally, Bach was in the Missouri Synod, if you didn't know. He's Orthodox. He had been Missouri Synod. But the Missouri Synod was one better than the Red Book. It didn't have any burial liturgy at all. It didn't even have a bad one. That's how Orthodox they are. So between the two of them, the Missouri Synod's not having one at all, and the Red Book having a bad one, we really do need a new burial liturgy. Let me talk about just a couple of things that are at stake theologically, and then say some good things about the new burial ritual that will be in the Lutheran Book of Worship. Theologically, our burial liturgies are things, are liturgies, rituals, for which we have practiced, in a sense, all of our lives. Our baptism is already a burial ritual. And that is, if we have enough water in the font, you know, here's another case where we built these little bird baths for baptismal fonts, and we don't really have very much water there. But if we had really good, great, big ones, best one I know of is in a Catholic church in Collegeville, Minnesota at St. John's Abbey. It's got a great big 16-foot pool in the beginning of the church as you walk in. And there's no way you can miss the fact that the only way into that community is through a pool you can drown in. Because that's literally what baptism is about. It is really about our being buried with Christ by baptism into his death, so that as he is raised from the dead, we too should walk in newness of life. And at St. John's, they have the steps going right down into that pool and then coming out the other side. That's what baptism is about. Now, what are the dynamics that this ritual, what is the experience that this ritual is trying to talk about? It is trying to talk about that dimension of our existence which must die so that the gospel can make us alive. And what has to die is all of our opposition to God and his will, all of the false gods that we set up in our lives, all of the mistrust of God that we have. That's gotta die. The only problem is it's like a cat. It has more than one life, and it keeps coming back. So Luther says baptism really initiates us into the daily drowning of that within us which must die. And the new person then comes to life. So death and resurrection are really the themes of what it means to be a Christian as such. We get that mark already at our baptism. If you think it's easy for me or anybody my age to talk about death and resurrection, then you are really thinking that we do not know something about dying before we die. Every confession of sins is a death. Every time my wife catches me speeding and says so, it's a death. Because I don't like to be caught doing something wrong. And there all of a sudden is the evidence, traffic cop or no. And she says, you're going over the speed limit. I say, take my foot off the speedometer very quickly. Say, no, 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 not at all. She says, come on. And I say, well, all right, I guess you're right. But it isn't easy to say it. And the harder, you know, I mean, any time we are caught is a kind of death. It really is. Ah, that's what Christianity is about. It is about nothing less than that. Death and resurrection every day, every confession, every sin, every encounter with God. We are practicing all of our lives for that. So what we are doing then when we finally bury a Christian is death and resurrection. Went to my father's bedside every Sunday the last 4 weeks of his life. And the first Sunday we went there, we drove up from Columbus, and the first Sunday we went there, he shooed my mother and Jan out of the room, and he just wanted to talk to me. He wanted to plan his funeral. All right, we planned his funeral. It was a great experience for me. Among other things, he wanted me to read Romans 4 at his funeral. I said, Dad, you're crazy. There are all kinds of good passages. What Romans? He said, read it. Hauled out Romans 4. Marvelous. It's about Abraham. It's about Abraham who looked at his own body, which was as good as dead, and trusted God who gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. I said, yeah, that is a great thing to be read at a funeral. So we read that, and we read other things at his funeral that he picked out. My father knew, I think, what a funeral ritual was to be about, death and resurrection, for him and for us. So, baptism shapes then the funeral liturgy. In the church where I was in Albany, we used to light the baptismal candles at every funeral because that was one of the things we wanted to do. We said the baptismal creed at the funeral, the Apostles' Creed. We did all kinds of things to link baptism and burial. And you do the same thing, as Jerry said. It works backwards into the baptismal rituals then, too. It makes what we do at baptism different because of what we do at funerals. And it makes funerals different because of what we do at baptism. The other thing is that we link Easter to the burial liturgies. I don't know how many of your churches do this, but I hope increasingly that churches are doing this. You get an Easter candle. That's a great big candle, and it always has the years on it, and you introduce it on Easter evening, the evening before Easter, when you have a great baptismal service, if your church is into this, and I hope it is. This is one of the ways to start. You link baptism with Easter, and Easter and baptism with this great candle. You set it by the altar all through the Easter season until Ascension Day, and then where do you move it? You move it to the baptismal font. Now that means, of course, that your church has to have a prominent baptismal font. I came to my parish in Albany, and I looked at the church, and I said to the man who was showing me through, where's the baptismal font? He went to a closet, and they rolled it out. He said, we don't use it very often. Well, yes, that is true. They didn't. But my goodness, it belongs as a central place in the church, even if you don't actually slosh water on a baby very often. It belongs centrally there. And when the Easter candle is through being used during the Easter season, you move it to the baptismal font, you light it for every baptism, and you carry it in the procession and light it for every funeral. So now we have linked three things: Easter, baptism, burial liturgies. The place for burial liturgies is the church, and that's the first thing for us to talk about in terms of ritual. City or suburb or country, the place to bury Christians is the church. No other place. I think this may mean that we're going to start having to have funerals maybe in the evening, when the factory workers are done and the office workers are done and the congregation can get together. And that's no problem, because you can have the funeral service in the evening and maybe commit the body to the grave the next day. I think that's one of the things we may just have to start doing, so we can have the congregation present. All of us need courage. We need courage to become Christians. We need courage to stay Christians, and we need courage to die as Christians. The courage comes from the gospel, but who bears the gospel? The people of God. Nothing is so awful, I think, as to bury somebody all alone. I've done it with nobody there, just me and the undertaker and the corpse. But what we need is people when there's a burial, people to give each other the courage to be Christians. And we are Christians to the extent that we are able to face honestly what has happened, not to make a cosmetic denial of what has happened, not to pretend that a death has not taken place. Baptism says death and resurrection, not just resurrection. It says the only way into life is through death. That's really what it says. So courage to face death, courage to believe in the resurrection from the dead. And the courage of the gospel comes through people. You don't even have to say anything. Just be there. Okay, the second thing is, if you've gathered a congregation, you do not just gather spectators. When the congregation gathers to give courage, to share the encouragement of the gospel, think of how many times that phrase is used in the New Testament, to share the encouragement of the gospel, they want to say things and they want to sing things. So we have to assume that the congregation that gathers is going to be able to sing and to pray and to witness to one another. To do that, we have to have familiar liturgies and familiar music. What I used to do when I was in the parish was to take the plain old Sunday morning service and just adapt it slightly to the burial. And when we started doing that, people said, oh my, that is worth coming to church for a funeral. We know what we are doing. We aren't doing something brand new. We are doing the old familiar liturgies. Now the new book of worship is going to give us just a structure, you see, in which we can use the music that is familiar to us from our liturgies and from our hymns. And then we can have, I think, a proper ritual at the church. Now, I want to say just, I've gone over 7 minutes, but that's all right. This is interesting. 14 is fine. I want to say just a couple of things. A funeral, the moment that someone dies, is not the time to change things. When a death has occurred, I think then we have to go along with whatever will be familiar and comfortable and encouraging to the people who have experienced the bereavement. This is one of the reasons why when I teach death courses in congregations, as I often do, I say to them, the time for all of us to be contemplating, thinking about this, is before there's a funeral. Write out your own burial instructions when you're well and healthy. Talk about this with your wife or your husband or your relatives when you're well and healthy. The time of death is not the time to plan these things. My father, that was so nice. 4 weeks he knew he was dying, we knew he was dying, he didn't fool anybody or try to, and we didn't. And he planned his burial at that point. And that was very good for us. When the moment came, when we got together to do the things that he wanted done, we knew what to do. So the time for this, the time for congregations to think about their rituals is not when there's a funeral, not at that moment, but at another time, you see, at a time when maybe there aren't any burials happening. That's when you think about what it is that you want to do and how you want to utilize the Christian tradition. The thing they're saying here is that the death of a member of the church should involve the pastor as soon as possible. He is not an employee of the funeral director, good as that funeral director may be. He is the servant of the gospel and the pastor of the bereaved. And he has his own function. He's not co-opted by the funeral director. The procession should involve the paschal candle. It should involve singing and liturgy, prayers. It should involve a funeral pall. Doesn't make any difference then whether you have a wooden box or a gold-plated casket. The funeral pall, which is an Easter color, white or gold, is available for everybody and should cover every casket, rich and poor alike, expensive and inexpensive, so that it doesn't make any difference. That's put on at the door. There is a procession into the church with the paschal candle. One of the things that's always bothered me is that in an effort to save a little bit of money, we haven't made it possible for us to have processions in our churches. We usually put our pews so close together that at most one person can walk comfortably down the aisle. I think it would help us, see, if we had chairs instead of pews, and then we could at funerals take a couple of rows of chairs out on each side of the aisle and have an aisle wide enough so that you can bring a casket in. The casket is not the object of the worship. When you bring a casket into the church, it remains lengthways. You don't roll it sideways so that it's like the altar. You keep it lengthways in the church. That's to say that our focus is the altar and the liturgy of the Christian community, not the casket. You bring the casket into the church, but you keep it this way. There are also some traditions which say if you're burying a pastor, you turn it around so that his head is towards the congregation. If it's a lay person, you leave it this way so that his head is toward the altar. But forget all of that. The main thing is don't make the casket crossways the center of attention. It is the altar that remains the center of attention. We signal that by the positioning of the casket. The ritual provides for the normal Sunday morning liturgy to which the Book of Worship suggests we may add the service of Holy Communion. And I think it would be very, very encouraging if we began to think in terms of doing that. Because the sacrament of the body and blood of Christ is there for us to get courage from Christ through one another. Remember, communion is people. We are the Holy Communion as Christ gives us his body and blood. I think that's very appropriate. I think it is long overdue that we begin to think in these terms again. It's not Catholic. We are not trying to have a mass said for the sake of somebody's soul. We are trying to gather encouragement from the gospel. And that's the point of these rituals. From the singing, from the liturgies, from the processions, from all the symbols that we use, and finally from the act of taking this body to the grave and burying it there in the hope of the resurrection, committing it to the earth in the hope of God's action. The one thing I want to add is that funeral and grief rituals do not end with the burial at the cemetery. One of the things that grief people tell us is that the most important thing for us to do is to keep up our ministry long after the funeral has ended. Days, weeks, months. The Jewish people are very good at this. There are 7-day rituals and 1-month rituals and 1-year rituals. and it's marvelous. Well, we need to do that too. Jerry, have you got 5 minutes for a